Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob, and good morning, everyone. It's great to have so many of you with us from all over the country and all over the world. TCAM looks very different this year, and so does Cornell. We're doing a lot of things in ways we've never done them before, including this State of the University presentation. But the state of our university right now, while it is different, is also remarkable. And I'm so glad to be able to share with you just a few of the highlights of the past year. I want to start out this morning by reminding you of Cornell's mission, which is to discover, preserve, and disseminate knowledge, to educate the next generation of global citizens, and to promote a culture of broad inquiry throughout and beyond the Cornell community. This past year, and in particular this pandemic, have shone a spotlight on how essential that mission is, by highlighting for everyone how a healthy, functioning society relies on the values of knowledge and truth, on the ability to communicate across difference, on a commitment to diversity, equity, and excellence, and of course, on education and research, in particular, the kind of exceptional education and research that are the hallmarks of Cornell University. The pandemic has also reminded us that our lives and society and really our whole world depend on a huge range of expertise, whether it's in public health and vaccine development or supply chains or labor policy or communication or teaching innovation or technology. And of course, we also need the art, the music, and the literature that are helping all of us survive and understand the strange times in which we're living. One might say that we need both any person and any study. And so it was clear to us from the moment that we made the decision to deactivate our campuses back in March that we needed to begin working on ways to keep Cornell moving forward. And as we did that, we embraced an important principle that our decisions around reopening would be based on science. We began, as Chairman Harrison noted, with detailed epidemiological modeling tailored to our circumstances here in Ithaca. Those models, which were developed under the supervision of one of our faculty members, Professor Peter Frazier, showed us something surprising, that our goal of having the healthiest possible semester for both our Cornell community and our Ithaca neighbors would be best met by inviting our students back to campus with a range of measures, including an extensive surveillance testing program. And as Chairman Harrison also noted, that result, that it was actually safer to bring students back to campus than to have a wholly online semester? Well, that result seems a little counterintuitive. But it followed from the fact that the majority of our students here in Ithaca live off campus. And we knew from student surveys and discussions with landlords that a large number of them were going to return to Ithaca no matter how we taught this semester. To control the spread of the virus, we needed to test those students frequently, along with our faculty and staff, to identify infected individuals as early as possible and get them into isolation, and then to identify, quarantine, and test their contacts. Test, isolate, contact trace. Those are the three steps of infection control 101. Now, here's the thing. If we had not opened for instruction, then as I've noted, thousands of students were still going to return to Ithaca and move into their privately leased apartments. We had no legal way of preventing that. If we had kept our campus deactivated, we would not have had the ability to influence their behavior by compelling them to sign and abide by a behavioral compact and requiring them to be tested on a regular basis to comply with contact tracing and to isolate if necessary. In short, we needed a way to enforce all of the necessary public health requirements, and we could only have that with an active campus. In fact, our epidemiological model estimated that the kind of in-person semester we planned would result in a reduction of infections by a factor of 6 to 9 relative to an all-online semester where we would have had less influence with our students. And once we knew that, we got to work, reconfiguring our classrooms, dining halls, and study spaces for physical distancing, upgrading our ventilation systems, putting together a public health campaign, sourcing adequate supplies, including PPE, designing a behavioral compact and putting in place mechanisms to enforce that compact, and handling the almost endless number of changes that we would need to mount in order to have a safe semester. But of all the challenges we met this past summer, I think that the most extraordinary was the need to stand up our own laboratory for coronavirus testing. Called the CCTL, the Cornell Coronavirus Testing Laboratory, it is housed in the Animal Health Diagnostic Center of the College of Veterinary Medicine, led by Dean Lauren Warnick, and developed under the leadership of Dr. Gary Koretsky, Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine and Vice Provost for Academic Integration. In creating it, we worked in close collaboration with the Cayuga Health System and the Tompkins County Health Department. And indeed, I cannot say enough about the incredible value of our collaborations with the local health system, the county health department, and other local governing bodies, both while we were planning and now into the fall semester. The CCTL uses pooled PCR testing, and it can process almost 50,000 samples per week with a turnaround time of less than 24 hours. That capacity enables us to do extensive surveillance testing of everyone in our Cornell community. And that's important. That's different from just testing for cause. We're not testing just people with symptoms or just the people who have had contact with someone who's known to be positive. We're testing everyone and we're testing them regularly. In the case of our undergraduates, twice a week. Of course, we do also do testing for cause, and we do what's called adaptive testing, where we expand our testing beyond the formal contacts of a known positive to further ensure that we catch all positives early. So for example, if a student in a sorority tests positive, we might test all of the other members of the sorority. And we're doing that with capacity that we built at Cornell. We are not drawing down local resources. In fact, to the contrary, last week, in collaboration with the Cayuga Health System, we donated $160,000 worth of testing capacity to the Ithaca City School District, testing more than 1,200 local students as the district prepared to reopen for in-person instruction this past Monday. Having our own lab is really what made it possible for us to even consider having an in-person semester, and our testing program is what distinguishes our reopening plan from that of many of our peers. To date, we have tested just under 165,000 samples since the start of classes on September 2nd. And in that period, we have had a total of only 101 positives, including a total of only 10 in the past 2 weeks. This is in a community of about 28,000 faculty, staff, and students here in Ithaca this fall. So we're seeing remarkably low testing positivity rates and remarkably low overall rates of infection, indeed, significantly lower than our epidemiological model had predicted, even when run with the optimistic parameters. Now, why is that? Well, it's due in no small part to our amazing students who have tackled this semester as true Cornellians, taking pride in doing what many people said couldn't be done and showing the world that even without football or hockey, Cornell can still beat Harvard. That said, we know that our success is fragile, and so we will remain vigilant. We're monitoring the situation carefully, keeping appropriate protocols in place, and we're making adjustments as needed. Now, while I've been focusing on our testing program, it's of course not the only thing that we're doing differently at Cornell this year. Think about move-in. Move-in is always an incredible logistical feat at Cornell, and this year I need to give a shout out to Student and Campus Life. They were amazing, and what they pulled off was nothing short of a logistical triumph. And yes, that's our Vice President of Student and Campus Life, Ryan Lombardi, on the right there behind the Cornell mask. It took 10 days and almost 200 staff volunteers to bring our students back into our residence halls. Each arriving student was tested for COVID-19 and then quarantined overnight until they received their results. That required 12,099 bed nights in area hotels, 1,349 shuttle rides, and approximately 30,000 quarantine meals picked up from three distribution tents, some of them under our inclement weather plan, because this is Ithaca and we always need an inclement weather plan. Classes began on September 2nd, with about 30% having an in-person component and the rest being taught virtually. Masks, of course, are required, and students sit in assigned seats with appropriate distance between them. And when students want to find a place to study, they can use our new Book a Study Space app, which finds and reserves available spaces like unused conference rooms or classrooms. Our dining halls are open, operating at reduced density. Students can dine in at distance tables if they make reservations with the Open Table app, or they can get takeout food from existing dining halls or one of three satellite locations where we're using reusable containers to reduce takeout waste. We've been careful to keep student favorites available across campus because, yes, it may be a pandemic, but this is still Cornell and our students still need their Cornell ice cream. In the absence of athletic competition, our student athletes have found ways to stay motivated and stay together. Whether it's the football team learning plays over Zoom or throwing themselves into Mask Up Mondays, a public health campaign that seniors on the team launched. And even though we're now finding those new and different ways to beat Harvard, I do want to note that before their season was interrupted by the pandemic, our men's and women's hockey teams last spring were both ranked number one in the nation. Despite all these changes and all of the challenges, our students overwhelmingly chose to return to their studies this fall. Indeed, we have a remarkable 97% of last year's enrollment. Of those, about 6,000 students are studying away from Ithaca this semester, and that includes almost 500 international students who are at 11 study away sites. These are partnerships we developed with universities around the world that enable our students to live and take classes at the partner university while also taking classes remotely at Cornell and receiving Cornell credit. So with 6,000 students away from Ithaca, although we still have full enrollment, we have a significantly de-densified campus. We have full enrollment at Weill Cornell Medicine and about 90% enrollment at Cornell Tech. This is a drop we expected given that students were making their decisions about what to do this fall, just as New York City was ground zero for coronavirus in this country. However, we saw enormous interest in our new urban tech hub at Cornell Tech, and we are quite optimistic that Cornell Tech enrollment as a whole will bounce back next year. And this is where I want to shift gears a little bit from how we've adapted our operations to the pandemic to how we've continued to pursue our mission throughout this extraordinary year. Because all of the work and planning and all of the enormous investment of resources that went into our reopening, all of that was done to enable the mission to continue. So I want to touch on just a few highlights of Cornell's activities across our four priorities of academic distinction, educational verve, civic responsibility, and One Cornell. And I'll start, as I always do, with academic distinction. Our faculty continue to lead their fields and to be recognized across disciplines for their extraordinary contributions. I would need much more time than I have this morning to tell you about all of our new Guggenheim, Wilson, and Packard Foundation fellows, our new inductees to the American Chemical Society, American Philosophical Society, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and our nine new NSF Early Career Awards. But I'm going to share just a few highlights, like the 2019 American Philosophical Association Book Prize that Associate Professor of Philosophy Kate Mann won for her book, Down Girl, the Johann Skeit Prize in Political Science, which was awarded to Peter J. Katzenstein, the Walter S. Carpenter Jr. Professor at the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies and Professor of Government in the College of Arts and Sciences. For the non-political scientists among you, the Johann Skeit Prize is the political science version of the Nobel Prize. And then there's the Carl Sagan Medal by the Division for Planetary Sciences of the American Astronomical Society, which was awarded to Ray Jayawardena, the Harold Tanner Dean of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Astronomy, for his excellence in public communication in planetary science. This is a particularly wonderful honor for Ray, who was inspired by Cosmos as a teenager growing up in Sri Lanka, and then met Sagan years later after moving to the United States. We're moving forward in our plans to strengthen the social sciences at Cornell, advancing the creation of a new school of public policy, which will be a separate school with its own dean, as well as new or expanded super departments in economics, psychology, and sociology. And we are deeply involved in helping to answer some of the most pressing questions of the pandemic, including the ongoing mystery of how one virus can produce no symptoms at all in some people and lethal disease in others. Weill Cornell Medicine's Clinical and Translational Science Center, the CTSC, has been awarded a two-year, $1.5 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to help answer this question by investigating the role of social and biological factors in determining COVID-19 severity and outcome in New York City patients. And in Ithaca, Cornell Nutritional Science professors Julia Finkelstein and Saurabh Mehta are leading a systematic review of the evidence of coronavirus transmission via breastfeeding. Their work will inform the World Health Organization's recommendations to governments and healthcare systems, which are being designed to help keep mothers and babies as safe as possible everywhere. Our second priority is educational verve. And in the words of Julia Tom Levy, our Vice Provost for Academic Innovation, we've never seen more educational verve at Cornell than we have this year. While everyone would obviously prefer to be living in a world where we could gather freely and teach without constraint in classrooms, given that that is just not possible right now, our primary goal is to set the standard for what is possible, finding the best ways to provide the world-class educational experience of Cornell in a manner that's safe for our students, faculty, and staff. For example, introductory physics, which is usually very hands-on and very lab dependent, this semester is being taught entirely online. As Professor Natasha Holmes puts it, our lab sequence asks, what does it mean to do an experiment in physics? And we've taken it farther than we used to, because we used to be restricted to what was in the lab. Now the options are almost endless. Like entire labs on electricity and magnetism done with Scotch tape, pendulum labs done with shoelaces and phone chargers, and labs that explore Hooke's law of elasticity done with standard weights that students quantify in their dorm rooms using everything from stacks of quarters to bottles of water. If you're taking entomology this semester, your lectures are online and you'll do your outdoor bug collecting with a mask in socially distanced manners. The professor also sends a treasure box of collection equipment and a cheap digital microscope to our remote students so they can collect insects from around the world. There are literally dozens of examples I could give you of the incredible innovation of our faculty as they teach this semester, but I know you don't want to be on Zoom all day, so let me instead turn to our third priority, civic responsibility. If we have ever had a moment in our history where we have been face to face with our common responsibility for our shared future, it's now. And Cornell's goal of carbon neutrality is more urgent than ever. Even as we continue to invest in renewable energy sources like solar, we also continue to pursue earth source heat, which has been part of Cornell's climate action plan since 2009. This is an ambitious proposal to heat most buildings on the Ithaca campus using a deep geothermal system that would draw on thermal energy stored deep within the earth. I'm delighted to share that in late January, Cornell secured a grant from the United States Department of Energy, expected to total about $7.2 million to fund exploratory research in the form of a 2-mile deep borehole to help verify the feasibility of this project. Beyond that, in June, the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education, ASHI, recognized our work by awarding Cornell its highest sustainability rating, Stars Platinum. We are the first Ivy League university and only the sixth university in the world to achieve this status. At Cornell, our purpose is not only knowledge for its own sake, but also knowledge with a public purpose. This year, thanks in large part to the generosity of Einhorn Collaborative, led by trustee David Einhorn, class of 91, 14 teams of Cornell faculty and community partners have received engaged research grants from the Office of Engagement Initiatives to increase undergraduate involvement in research that strengthens the well-being of communities, including projects that support the state's dairy industry, protect our water supply, and strengthen food security. Now, as everyone is aware, along with the pandemic, our nation was rocked last spring and summer by the killings of Black Americans, followed by months of protests for social justice. As an academic community built on the bedrock values of diversity, inclusion, and openness, we have an obligation to ensure that the forces of these events and our feelings drive us not backwards, but forwards, which is why we put into place a series of actions in response: strengthening community involvement in public safety, holding community conversations on race and racism, and supporting a range of faculty and staff-led projects that will expand our commitment to being a welcoming community for any person, and a community that sends its students out to help create a more inclusive world. Also, as part of our commitment to our core values, faculty from our American Indian and Indigenous Studies program are now advancing several initiatives that address the role of the expropriation of Indigenous lands in the creation of land-grant universities like ours. Campus-level activity through our Belonging at Cornell framework is being coordinated by our Presidential Advisors on Diversity and Equity, which is chaired by Professor of Microbiology and Immunology and Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, Avery August, pictured here at the kickoff event for the Belonging at Cornell initiative. And I could not talk about civic responsibility today without mentioning one alumna who lived that responsibility until the very last day of her life, the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, class of 54. Justice Ginsburg frequently referred to the formative experiences she had as an undergraduate at Cornell, both in her classes and outside of them. It was at Cornell that she learned to write, learned to cherish the Constitution, and it's where she met her husband, the late Martin Ginsburg, 53, whom she later referred to as, quote, the first guy I ever dated who cared that I had a brain. I'm delighted to announce that a fund has been created for the Ruth Bader and Martin D. Ginsburg program, established by Jeff, class of 79, and Christy Weiss, and supported by a number of caring donors. It will be used to create a program at Cornell honoring the interests of the justice and her husband. And we also wanted to create a physical reminder at Cornell of Justice Ginsburg's time here. And those discussions came together with ongoing discussions about how best to honor the memory of her fellow alumna, the late Toni Morrison, Masters of Arts 55, critically acclaimed novelist, essayist, and professor, and winner of both the Pulitzer Prize and the Nobel Prize in Literature. Ms. Morrison is also being recognized through a series of events at Cornell this year. For both these extraordinary Cornellians, we wanted to create a memorial that would be seen by and have its doors open to any person at Cornell, reminding all of our Cornell students, not just those in a particular field or college, that their path from Cornell can take them anywhere. So I am truly delighted to announce that we will be honoring Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Toni Morrison by naming for each of them one of the new North Campus Residential Expansion Halls. The opening of these halls, NCRE, will mark the beginning of a new chapter in residential life at Cornell, one that will be focused on building community and supporting communication across difference, revitalizing and in many ways reinventing the student experience here. In years to come, every Cornell freshman and sophomore will live on campus, starting their time here on North Campus, and every one of them will see on that campus the names of two of our most accomplished alumni. And that brings me to my fourth and final priority, One Cornell. I simply cannot say enough about the way that the Cornell community around the world has come together during this crisis, offering assistance and support of every kind. Among the many challenges we faced as an institution since March, one of them, of course, has been financial. The cost of transforming our campus, including mounting and running our own testing lab, has been enormous. And that impact has been compounded by lost income from our enterprise units, like our hotel and the campus-to-campus bus, from lost tuition from international graduate students who haven't been able to enroll, and from our reduced housing and dining income. But all of that is actually small relative to the increased costs of our commitment to meeting the full financial need of our undergraduates. Our budget office anticipates that about 3,000 Cornell students will experience pandemic-related changes to their financial situations just this year, resulting in up to an additional $90 million in financial need. And we expect a significantly increased degree of need to continue for the next few years. Now, we've done a great deal to keep the university budget on an even keel throughout these changes, including hiring and pay freezes, targeted cuts in university spending, a modest increase in our endowment payout rate, and reductions in employee benefits and/or pay including significant voluntary reductions to my salary and those of other senior administrators. We've also frozen most construction, although we are moving forward with important projects that we had already begun, such as the North Campus residential expansion. These measures have helped us balance the budget for both the current fiscal year, the one that just ended this past summer, and so far, the current fiscal year. But there is no way that we could have managed to meet the financial need of our students without the incredible generosity of so many of you. Here I want to particularly thank Dave Duffield, who helped get the Cornell Promise Initiative for Student Financial Aid off to a strong start, and to everyone on the Board of Trustees who has stepped forward to help or is planning or considering gifts as we head towards the end of the year. Thanks in large part to all of you. Gifts to the Cornell Promise now total over $26 million. And thanks to you, we've continued to meet the full need of every student and continue to honor Ezra Cornell's promise to keep our doors open to any student for any study. And that's the note I want to end on before turning to your questions. Those of you who were at TCAM last year might remember that I talked about how Ezra Cornell, in the turbulent years of the Civil War, sought ways to invest his fortune that would not return the greatest dividends of money, but the greatest dividends in good. For the last 155 years, that's exactly what Cornell has done, pursued its mission of teaching, engagement, and research to create the greatest good, not just for our students, but for our community, our society, and our world. In times good and bad, through wars, through upheaval, through unrest, and yes, through more than one pandemic, we've continued on as an institution where any person can find instruction in any study, where truth is sought for its own sake, where knowledge has a public purpose, and where our ideals are matched by our excellence. I am so proud to be a part of this incredible community, and I am so grateful to all of you for keeping Cornell strong on our campuses and wherever Cornellians might be. Thank you very much.